Good morning. The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Brian, Judge Ross, and Judge Flory, the Honorable Judge Jeffrey M. Brian presiding. We're now calling case A20-0597 in the matter of Brinkman.
Good morning, and thank you for joining us this morning and participating remotely in our arguments. I'll make a couple of reminders before we begin. First of all, if you would please remember to state your name before you make your argument. That way on the audio recording, it'll be clear who is arguing on behalf of whom. In addition, because we are appearing in this way remotely, sometimes there are unexpected glitches or interruptions, pets, doorbells, family members, and I would ask that you be patient with us if that happens on our end, and we'll do the same to you. I think we can all do the best we can to limit those interruptions this morning. And last is that if you have any problems, let us know right away so we can try to correct them. And I think you've been told this, but I'll repeat this if you have. And if you haven't, this might be a good piece of advice to keep in mind. You can toggle between active speaker view and gallery view. If you use active speaker view, the person speaking shows up in a large window and everybody else is in smaller thumbnails. And that means that the clock we're using, which is on the Marshall screen, also shows up, but it's really small. And so sometimes people don't even see it if they're in active speaker view. So if you could remember to move to gallery view, that way you should be able to see the clock and know how much time is remaining. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Jill Frieders on behalf of the appellant, Robert Brinkman. The issues before the court are the district court's calculation of the marital value of the Custom Communications Incorporated shares and the marital interest in the Johnson Family Partnership. I will address Custom Communications, or CCI, first. Ms. Brinkman owns 185.8 shares of Custom Communication shares. She has 27.16% interest in the corporation, and she owns the largest block of shares. 21 of her shares are 100% marital. They were purchased during the marriage with marital money. 164.8 shares were gifted to her, and the appreciation on those shares is marital. The district court erred by undervaluing the marital portion of the CCI shares, and he erred in three ways. The court failed to hold Ms. Brinkman to her burden of proof. It is her burden of proof to prove her non-marital interest in the CCI shares. She failed to do so. She failed to present credible evidence as to value of the shares at the time of the gifts. The court, without the appropriate and relevant evidence, by his own findings, extrapolated, estimated, and assumed to come up with a historic value of the shares at the time of the gifts.
So, Ms. Frieders, just so I understand your argument, because when you talk about the burden of proof here, your client did testify at trial that a portion of those shares were non-marital. So it seems he acknowledged that. It seems to me your argument goes in terms of the burden of proof to whether what the evidence was in terms of the value of those shares, as opposed to whether there was a marital versus non-marital interest in them. Is that a fair assumption on my part?
It is. We offered the gift tax returns as evidence as to the gift value. Barenberg versus Barenberg indicates that gift tax returns are credible evidence of the value of gifts at the time of the gifts. We offered that and agreed that that was the value of the shares at the time of the gifts. Ms. Brinkman, on the other hand, impeached that evidence. She called the accountant to prepare the gift tax returns, and he testified that he didn't value the shares appropriately at the time of the gifts, that he relied on the donors to tell them what the value was, and that was Ms. Brinkman's parents were the donors. And the donor, Ms. Brinkman's father, Lee Johnson, testified he wasn't really sure how everything was valued at the time either. So, and the only other evidence that Ms. Brinkman provided with respect to the value of the shares at the time of the gifts was her expert, who said that he did a lowball valuation of the business, and he said the per share value was $683.48, and that there was absolutely no appreciation from the time of gift to the time of divorce. And the district court found that that was not credible evidence either. So the court found the gift tax returns to lack credibility, found Ms. Brinkman's expert testimony to lack credibility, and was then left with no evidence as to the value of the shares that were gifted between 2007 and 2012. And he basically guessed. I think he tried to do the best job he could with the evidence that he had, but he did not have sufficient evidence to value the shares retroactively. The next mistake that the trial court judge made was that after he came up with a value for the shares, he reduced the marital value of the shares by 50% by using a windfall discount. And there's simply no such thing as a windfall discount. And that is—
If I could jump in, Ms. Frieders, are you aware of any case by this court or the Minnesota Supreme Court that looks at that breaks our analysis of marital appreciation in two steps? The first step being, is it active or passive? If it's active, then there's a second step. And in that second step, you're assigning percentages of responsibility for the increase in value. And if the spouse was responsible for 50%, then you discount by 50. If the spouse was responsible by 75%, you might discount by 25%, and so on. Are you aware of any case by our court or the Supreme Court that would break apart our analysis? This is a legal matter, a purely legal question, that would break apart our analysis on marital appreciation into two steps. First, active and passive, and secondly, parsing out the active efforts to apportion some amount. Or is it that all of our case law only deals with that first step? And if it's active, period, end of analysis, it's now marital.
Yes, Your Honor. So there are cases that talk about active versus passive. So as an example, a couple owns shares in IBM. None of them are executives at IBM. They're not on the board, nothing to do with IBM except hold some shares. That appreciation would be considered passive and not be considered marital. I think there's Nardini stands for that. And I think case law follows from that. But when there's also there's cases where it might be a closely held corporation, but the shareholder did not work in the corporation, that would be considered passive appreciation. But 100% of the cases from Nardini on that deal with a closely held corporation where one of the parties is employed in that corporation, that is considered active appreciation, and it is considered a marital asset. There's one outlier, and that outlier case is Duffy. And Duffy was unique in that it dealt with retained earnings and is considered an outlier and not part of this analysis of active or passive appreciation in closely held corporation.
Just so I'm clear, is the answer to your question, answer to Judge Bryant's question, no, you're not aware of any case that takes a two-step analysis once determining active participation? There's a pro rata assessment made, a proportionate assessment made after that point.
There are no cases that make a proportionate assessment once there's analysis that there's active appreciation. There is not a single case in Minnesota. And I even tried to find cases in other states and could not find them. So the approach that Judge Chase took is unique and I think inappropriate. But even if it were appropriate to say that only a portion of depreciation should be attributable to marital effort, there was not testimony in this case to flush out what the appropriate percentage should be. Judge Chase merely said 50% was the number he was using, was the discount that he was using, because otherwise Mr. Brinkman would receive an equitable windfall.
And let me jump in here too, because I have another question. Let's assume that the district court had looked at our case, let's say Baker, for example, that says in the absence of evidence that it's active, a court should find that it's passive, right? We have evidence that it's active. We have a district court who found it was not passive. Let's assume then at that time, our district court declares the appreciation a purely marital asset. Is there anything that would prevent the district court from looking at the factors that it's supposed to look at to divide that asset in an equitable manner and give wife the bulk of the asset as part of the property division? Isn't that something the court could have done?
So I think your question is, could the courts have awarded a disproportionate share of the marital estate to the wife?
Well, so yes, because if we're looking at this windfall discount, another way of doing that is to say this is a marital asset, but to avoid some inequity, we're going to have a disproportionate division of that asset or a disproportionate division of the entire estate. Isn't that something the district court could have done if it was concerned about the equities of the situation, as opposed to declaring 50% of the marital appreciation as not being marital?
So could the court have awarded a disproportionate share of the marital estate? I believe that the court can do that. But in a long-term marriage where both parties have actively participated in that marriage and worked, the Supreme Court case has said, the Supreme Court has said that there's a presumption in favor of a equal distribution of the marital estate. And the case on point is Miller v. Miller, 352 Northwest 2nd, 738.
Right, but just because there's a presumption doesn't mean that equitable factors that the district court can't apply equitable factors to rebut the presumption of an equal division. And isn't that implicitly what happened here?
Well, explicitly, the court discounted the marital value of the shares. And there's others, it's cited in my brief, but there's also Court of Appeals cases that say you cannot identify something that is clearly marital as non-marital just to prevent the other spouse from sharing in that asset.
Ms. Frieders, I think you anticipated my next question when you answered the one I had asked. I had asked, could the court have done this if it wanted to look at the equities of the situation, avoid some kind of windfall? Could the court have done it? I think the answer is yes. But my next question, which is kind of what you answered, is what findings or what decision or what analysis would the court have had to have done? And is there anything in our order that we can look to that would satisfy that analysis?
So my understanding of division of marital assets is that they do not have to be exactly equal. But in long-term marriages, they're supposed to be close to equal. And when a court's going to award a disproportionate share of the marital estate to a party, there needs to be some showing of hardship, something along those lines, wherein maybe you have a spouse who has little access to money, and it would be unfair to burden them with the marital debt. So maybe the marital debt gets disproportionately awarded to the moneyed spouse. We don't have anything like this in this case. This is a situation where the parties both are employed. They both make very good incomes. Before bonuses, their incomes are comparable. With bonuses, Ms. Brinkman makes dramatically more than my client does. It's hard to understand what the hardship to Ms. Brinkman would be. And more importantly, the judge in this case did not make any sort of hardship findings or analysis. The court simply just didn't want Mr. Brinkman to share fully in the marital portion of the appreciation on the shares of CCI. And it's hard to understand. If a judge had, I really believe that if the owner of the shares had been the man, I don't think we would be having this discussion. I think there's some sort of belief that Mr. Brinkman just didn't deserve to share in the marital estate. And Nardini makes it very clear that both spouses are to share in the marital estate.
I just want to be clear. I'm not suggesting that you're making this overt accusation, but are you implying a gender bias in the district court's decision?
I will say that there are no cases where a woman does not get to receive the full amount of the marital estate, at least the full amount of the marital estate in these kinds of cases. I mean, there's just nothing. The judge doesn't make any biased findings, but the outcome is in effect biased. This is a case where a man doesn't get to share in the full amount of the marital estate. And that doesn't seem fair to me. I'm out of time. I will address if I have time later, I will address our issue with respect to the Johnson Family Partnership.
Thank you very much. Mr. Braun.
Thank you very much. Good morning. Thomas Braun appearing this morning from Restovich Braun and Associates on behalf of Ms. Brinkman. We're before the court this morning asking to affirm the district court's various rulings with respect to the valuation of CCI, the Johnson Family Partnership, and the allocation of the non-marital and marital interests. Let me first start by talking about the appeal that has been brought related to the discounts applied, because I think that's really the easiest place to start because the law is very clear. The standards of review are extremely important when analyzing the appellant's objections. And with respect to the
I understand, Mr. Braun, let me make sure, because there's multiple discounts. There's the first discount that is based on the collective work, more than just wife's efforts, but collective efforts of wife and family and other people who work there. And then there are the other two discounts for lack of control, lack of marketability. I'm assuming you're talking about the discretion that might be or the deference that might be afforded to a district court who's hearing a battle of the experts regarding the degree of discount for lack of marketability and control. And you're not talking about the legal issue that is that we wouldn't have any deference to the district court on regarding the characterization of the marital appreciation as non-marital based on the contributions of other people in addition to wife's efforts.
That's correct. I'm not speaking about that yet. I will address that. I think that the discount for control and marketability is a very easy issue for the court to address because the standard of review is clearly erroneous. And the court adopted one of the expert, Mr. Schmidt's opinion with respect to these discounts, which were appropriate. Mr. Schmidt went on site, talked to management, did all the legwork you would expect that an evaluator or an appraiser do in a case like this. Mr. Reitman essentially asked management to fill out a form. He did not go on site. He did not talk to management. So I think the court is well within its authority to apply the discount that they did with respect to marketability and control. With respect to the other two challenges that appellant has brought regarding the valuation of CCI, the first I want to address talks about the purported lack of meeting her burden of proof with respect to the non-marital value of the shares at the time they were gifted. I think that that issue is framed really improperly because Ms. Brinkman put a number of exhibits into evidence with respect to the value of the shares. And the value of the shares at the time of the gifting was talked about through the Smith-Schaefer experts, talked about through Pat Schmidt. Pat Schmidt took a different way of looking at historical value and analyzed it by way of revenue. Judge Chase chose a different methodology of valuation, and he did so by adopting Mr. Reitman's essentially RMR analysis to find value with respect to the shares. And this issue was addressed by Judge Chase on appellant's motion for amended findings, which is contained on page 25 of the memorandum attached to appellant's addendum. And, you know, this is not a case of Judge Chase evaluating really apples and oranges. Appellant has acknowledged that there's no mathematical errors here. He's just saying that appellant didn't produce the evidence that the judge ultimately used in reaching his decision. You know, that's typical that a judge will take all the evidence in the case, look at the facts, and reach a middle position. And that's exactly what the judge did in this case. And the court, I think in Trumbo versus Minnesota Valley Natural Gas, clearly identifies this ability for the court to extrapolate reasonably from the facts that are given. And in the judge's memorandum attached to the order, he sets forth the methodology that he used. He relied on expert evidence that was admitted through exhibits to extrapolate share price. I take objection to counsel's suggestion that he just guessed as to what the share price was. There was a methodology. It was reasonable. And he imposed those numbers based on the data and the evidence submitted to the court, which was largely unobjected to. So
well, let's get to Judge Brian's question, Mr. Braun, that he asked your co-counsel here. What about the 50% reduction that he did based on the windfall or whatever you want to call it? As Judge Brian asked Ms. Frieders, can you direct us to some authority in Minnesota where active appreciation has been separated out to look at the factors that the judge relied on here? And where in the record is there support for what the judge did?
Sure. Thank you, Your Honor. No, there is no authority that would follow essentially the procedure or protocol that Judge Chase set forth in his opinion. That's not to say that what he did was inappropriate or in any way violative of Nardini or Minnesota case law. And I think that the court in his, Judge Chase in his memorandum talked about Nardini. Clearly that's the case that is most on point with respect to this issue. And he addressed why Nardini simply doesn't apply. And the facts of Nardini are very, very different than what we have in this case. You know, in Nardini, you had a partnership, a husband and wife, 100% owners. The wife in that case did sporadic bookkeeping, but primarily was a homemaker. Her efforts at home helped her husband appreciate the value of the business, dedicate his time and attention to the business, so thus the business value grew. The court found that the Nardini facts were not similar to what we have in this case. And frankly, you know, Nardini is now 23 years old and is somewhat antiquated. You know, in today's world, we have dual earning spouses who are both working full time, which is exactly what we have here. Had Mr. Brinkman been kind of the stay-at-home parent, contributed in a manner which was consistent to what happened in Nardini, I think that the court would have a harder time saying that these facts are not the same. But frankly, that's just not the case. The court looked at also who contributed to the value of the appreciation. In Nardini, it was both husband and wife. Here, in this case, we have the contribution of many other individuals who attributed to the valuation.
All right,
of
and that's the point. So the court, I want to press Mr. Braun, because that Nardini isn't the issue, right? The issue is, as far as I see it, the district court, once it decides that wife's efforts were active, not passive, right? Once it made that decision, I don't see how it could then look to third parties' contribution. Let's look at Baker, for example. And I know that in Baker, the Supreme Court ultimately said that those efforts of Dr. Baker were passive because Dr. Baker had an investment portfolio that he did not manage. He paid someone else to manage that investment portfolio for him, right? And so for that reason, those were passive. But the whole reason that Baker might be important to us here is the controversy in Baker was if his management or if his control over the investment portfolio was enough to make it active, that's why it's relevant for us, right? Because there was no suggestion, and there hasn't been, to my knowledge, in any Minnesota Supreme Court or Court of Appeals case, that you can look to the contributions of third parties to determine how much of a person's of an asset's appreciation during the marriage is marital versus non-marital, right? In Baker's situation, the companies he's investing in, they are presumably, there are people working at those companies, market forces, all kind of industry issues that are responsible for the performance of those companies in which he's invested. That third party responsibility has no bearing on the amount that would have been declared marital had Dr. Baker's control over that investment portfolio been the deciding factor as opposed to his efforts. So my issue isn't with the application of Nardinius as much as it is that the district court, in my view, maybe created a whole new way of analyzing marital appreciation that takes into consideration the contributions of other people besides just wife. And if that's the case, I think you have undone the point of this distinction between active and passive efforts, because there are very few circumstances where someone's efforts alone are responsible for the increase. There's almost always going to be some contributions that other people have made. And so by making this new rule of law that you reduce the marital appreciation by some degree of responsibility that you attribute to other people besides the spouse in question, you have, in as a matter of law, changed the characterization of marital property. So what case is there that would support this new rule of law that the district court applied?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. And I understand your point. I think it's not necessarily a case which drives it home, but rather it's statutory. It's 518.58 subdivision 1. And it's quoted in Nardini when the court in Nardini talked about equity denotes fairness and requires application of the dictates of conscience and principle and natural justice to the settlement of controversies. And Judge Chase quotes directly from that paragraph because I think he understood what he was doing here by reducing the active appreciation by 50%. He was using the court's equities. And
is that, let me jump in, because is that paragraph and is the equitable power that the court has related to characterizing property as marital or non-marital?
I don't think it relates to the characterization of the property. And I don't know that Judge Chase did that. I think what he did is he clearly identified that the 50% ownership related to the active appreciation would be discounted because of the equities. And the Brockman case, you know, stands for the court's ability to reduce property awards.
Okay, you know, so again, equities. Mr. Braun, I think we're mischaracterizing here what the district court did. Whose side of the balance sheet did that first 50% that it was reduced by 50%, right? So that amount of money that is cut out, whose side of the balance sheet does that fall on? No one's, right?
Well,
because it was non-marital. Yeah. So we're not
correct.
Talking about the equities or the values that the district court's supposed to look at to divide marital property. We're talking about a decision that the district court made to take it out of the marital estate. And so what is the case that allows a district court to do that?
Well, and again, there is no case that allows the district court to do that. What Judge Chase, I believe, relied on in doing that was how distinct Nardini is and the equities of the court under 518.58. And because this was so different than Nardini, he believed that a different determination was equitable and needed to further the ends of justice, as the Nardini court talks about in making just an equitable property division. you know, Judge Chase in this protocol kind of, or in this framework that he evaluated.
Again, I'm going to jump in. So the statute that you're talking about is about dividing marital property. So if he were to have used that statute, then there would be this first 50% would appear on a balance sheet and it would be awarded to one party or the other, but that's not what happened. So what's in 51858 wasn't applied, right? Because the district court said it was non-marital.
Well, on that point, Your Honor, I have to respectfully disagree because Judge Chase talked about what the 50% appreciation would be awarded to Mr. Brinkman would be absent this deduction that he's making out of equity. So I think the memorandum clearly spells that out on page 6 of his analysis and 5 for that matter. So I think it's important that when the court really examines how this deduction is made, it looks at it in the context of equity because that's exactly how the district court viewed it. And I think that on this issue, because we're talking about property division, this should be an abuse of discretion standard, not a de novo review, because Nardini is being identified and followed to the extent that the judge is identifying the active and passive components of the appreciation, but then makes this deduction out of equity based on 518.58. And I just want to say a few things quickly. My time is going quickly here, but I want to talk about the Johnson Family Partnership just very briefly. The two issues raised, we do not believe merit remand or reversal. To suggest that the property was purchased with marital property, the second lot, no funds ever came from Mr. and Mrs. Brinkman to purchase that property. That was all retained earnings. And the discounts applied were based on the expert who gave the opinion with respect to what he believed that corporation's discounts should be. We're not just valuing real property in this case. It is a limited partnership, one which my client has no voting rights and has never made any financial contributions. Thank you.
No, I'm going to ask one. Oh, go ahead, Mr. Flory, Judge Flory. I think you're muted, Judge.
Thanks, Judge Brian. My question is about the record. I want to make sure that I'm understanding the record correctly on the partnership. Your client has a 16% interest in the partnership that was gifted to her. At the time of the gift, the only asset was the real property that CCI leases. They've since acquired some others. So my question is her 16% interest in the assets as they now exist, is it a 16% interest in the partnership or in the assets owned by the partnership?
Really in the partnership, which then owns the assets. So the partnership also has, you know, bank accounts and there's debt, you know, so she's a 16% owner in everything that the family partnership has, not just the real property.
All right. That answers my question. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Rebuttal, Ms. Frieders.
Quickly on the family partnership. Our position is the court erred in determining that there was a non-marital interest in the lot purchased after the gifts. We agree to the calculation the judge used with respect to the original real estate. Don't agree with his discount rates, but that's not going to spend a lot of time on that. But what we disagree is the lot that was purchased during the marriage was purchased with money earned during the marriage. All of the money within that corporation is derived from rental income paid to it by CCI. And to the extent that it was retained in the corporation to purchase the real estate means that it wasn't paid out as income to the Brinkman family. Instead, it was held in the corporation. And to give her a non-marital interest in an asset that was purchased with income earned during the marriage would deprive Mr. Brinkman of an asset that is marital.
Ms. Frieders, I'm concerned a little bit with the partnership analysis because It seems to me that we should be making a distinction between owning real estate and owning an interest in a company or an entity that has among its assets real estate. Mm-hmm. And why are we equating the business interest with an ownership interest in the assets that that business owns and using Schmitz at all?
That's a way that it's commonly done. It's most certainly not the only way it can be done. But in any event, whether a Schmitz formula is applied or another analysis is applied, an acknowledgement that the earnings that are held in that corporation are marital needs to be accounted for. So I want to get back to the CCI, which is the bigger issue here. I want to point out that the judge relied on, he had to make some assumptions to come up with value. There was not evidence to support these assumptions. He had to assume the effect of the sound and media spinoff. He made assumptions about what the sound and media income was prior to its spinoff in 2014. He says he's making assumptions. He had to make assumptions about the rate of growth, even in recession years. He talks about making assumptions there. He had to make assumptions about the company's sales between 2007 and 2013. There wasn't information in the file for that. There wasn't information presented at trial for that. He had to retroactively extrapolate what he assumes that amount would have been. And he confuses recurrent monthly revenue with revenue. Gross receipts for the corporation is different than the recurrent monthly revenue, which is how the expert valued the business in the first place. Another issue is the judge indicated that he was not given any authority for the proposition that a corporation owned by more than one person or more than one family, outside of the family, a corporation owned by more than just the husband and wife is subject to the calculations that are set forth in Nardini. We provided him with the Barenberg case. The Barenberg case is clearly on point. Mr. Barenberg and his father and mother owned the corporation. His father was the ultimate decision maker and in control of all major decisions of the corporation. Mr. Barron worked there. He helped manage the Lincoln Dell South and other aspects of the businesses, but his dad was the controller. Mr. Barenberg argued that Nardini only applied to cases where the corporation was owned by husband and wife, and the Court of Appeals rejected that. And clearly states that Nardini does not hold a limitation to being applicable only to closely held corporations that are owned by the spouses. So that argument, I think, is not appropriate. We request that the court determine that 50% discount be inappropriate by law and ask that, and that Ms. Brinkman failed to prove her non-marital interest in the shares. Thank you.
Thank you very much to both counsel. Thank you for your briefs. We will take the matter under advisement and issue an opinion within the statutory time frame.
Thank you.
And that concludes the calendar.